On Tuesday, President Trump finally unveiled his deal of the century, his vision for peace in the Middle East. This could be a game changer. This could make history. Yet there are lots of questions surrounding this deal. Welcome to the Yeshiva World Podcast. My name is Yaakov M. Remember to check out my 24-hour news hotline at 848-261-NEWS, 848-261-6397. Is President Trump's Middle East peace plan really a two-state solution? Will the Israelis be forced to make major concessions? What will the status of Jerusalem be? What impact will the settlement freeze have? Does Trump really expect Mahmoud Abbas to come to the table? I spoke with Middle East expert Binyamin Rose of Mishpacha magazine. I asked him these questions and more. As always, Binyamin was extremely clear and articulate. He has a firm grasp on these issues, which is truly unparalleled. Let's get right to it. Binyamin Rose on the Yeshiva World Podcast. Here now on the Yaakov M. Show and Yeshiva World News, Middle East expert Binyamin Rose. Binyamin is the editor-at-large of Mishpacha magazine. He was the news editor for nearly a decade and a half. Binyamin, always great to speak with you.
Likewise, Yaakov.
President Trump has finally released his deal of the century. And before we get to the specifics, there have been two reactions to this by the Israelis that I've seen. Many people see this as extremely beneficial: sovereignty over much of Judea and Samaria, control over Yerushalayim within the security barrier, demilitarization of the Palestinians. And then there's others who say this is a two-state solution. And the bottom line is we cannot agree to a deal which creates a Palestinian state. So what are your thoughts on that loaded question?
Well, when you read a 181-page document like the Trump administration put out, you're going to have more than one opinion on what it entails and how it reads. I just want to start by saying that one of the concerns I had all along through this whole process of the deal of the century, even though it only took 3 years in the making and not a century, but one of the concerns that I had all along was how deeply was the Trump team going to delve into every issue that's involved in trying to make peace and trying to make something happen here. And browsing through the document as I did, you really have to give them a lot of credit for how deeply they really delved into the entirety of the situation here. So they deserve credit for that.
Yeah.
As far as the reaction is concerned, the reaction I think is predictable. One thing I noticed is that the left wing, especially if you can indicate that by looking at Haaretz, is quite upset about this because their dream of peace was two states for two people and us here and them there. And obviously that was never possible because the two populations are too closely intertwined. So they're upset. The right, I think, is probably happier than they are letting on to be from the viewpoint that you're right. This is a two-state solution, and President Trump even used the term two-state solution, and it's in the document. However, really, the first steps are up to us. And if you take a look at what could happen next, if Netanyahu and the Israeli government play their cards right, is that Israel will be able to take steps to annex or apply sovereignty over 30 to 40% of the West Bank, all of the areas that almost all of the Jews who settled there after the 1967 war lived in. And then basically this clock starts ticking on the Palestinian side. They have 4 or 5 years to decide whether they want to get on board or not. And if not, then basically you've got a lot of the rest of the West Bank that's potentially up for grabs. So I think most right-wing people are looking at is, we're going to take the first steps. We're going to consolidate our hold on the areas that are vital to us. And then we'll see what happens after that.
So that's very interesting, because that was what I was going to ask next. Is one thing Trump has accomplished already, he has brought two sides together who despise each other, and that's Hamas and Fatah. You know, Trump has already made peace in the Middle East because they can't stand each other, and yet they are unified in their opposition to this deal. So I was going to ask you the game plan, and it sounds like you preempted. You're saying that right now, there's the green light, basically. Israel can say, all right, look, we are annexing the parts of Judea and Samaria where we already have a presence, already have settlements. And is that the game plan where, okay, let's do that first? That's out of the way now. That's kind of the premise. And now the Palestinians have a few years to get on board?
Right. Just like President Trump took Jerusalem off the table and took the Golan Heights off the table, he's now taken most of the settlements and a decent chunk of the West Bank off the table as well, and has basically put it into Israeli hands. One thing, though, that's important to point out, though, Yaakov, is that even if you consider the amount of territory in the West Bank that Israel is about to annex or is entitled to an X now, according to the Trump plan, it's still only about half of what's known as Area C that Israel already has full control of. So we have to temper the enthusiasm and keep in mind that what Trump is giving us, so to speak, is only half of the area of what we really control now under Area C, which was the area set up under the Oslo Accords that was to remain under full Israeli military and civilian control.
Okay, all right. And without getting too into the weeds here, Area C, if you could describe that in a little more detail, and why is it, on the one hand, the plan says that Israel, you know, will basically be able to control all areas that it currently has settlements in, it currently has a presence in, and yet you're saying it's only half of Area C. So if you could just explain that.
So under the Oslo Accords, the West Bank, which consists of Judea and Samaria, to us who have a more biblical bent. So it was divided into three different areas. Area A, so those were mainly the larger Palestinian cities like Bethlehem, Ramallah, Jenin, Shechem, and, or Nablus as the Arabs call it. And this was the area about 20% of the West Bank, which was under total Palestinian control. Meaning, in essence, it's a no-go zone for Israelis. Now, the military, after Ariel Sharon went back into the West Bank after the Pesach Night Massacre in 2002, I believe it was, so we basically allowed ourselves to go back into Area A in order to conduct any military expeditions that we needed to. But to make it short, again, 20% of the West Bank is under full Palestinian security control and civilian control. Another 20% is Area B, and that's mostly the suburban areas around the big cities. And in Area B, what you have is Palestinian civilian control, but Israel has free rein to send the not to send the military in, but basically to patrol it as they see fit. Of course, to send the military in, but to patrol it. Area C is under total Israeli control, and that's again where most of the Jewish settlers live, and a small minority of Palestinians as well, a neighborhood of about 100,000. Now, it's interesting, the Trump plan does not refer to any of these areas. It doesn't talk about A, B, and C. Basically, it wipes out the Oslo map, and it makes a new map of its
own. Right, just draws a new map, right. Now, will this be perceived as too big a concession, giving up all this land in Area C?
I think among certain elements in the right, what bothers them more is the idea that the plan even talks about the possible creation of a Palestinian state, even though if you read the fine print and look at all the conditions, it would be almost impossible for the Palestinians to accept this. You would have to have a Nelson Mandela type ruler to come in and say, you know something, folks, let's put the past aside and let's try to make a new future together. I don't see that happening. So I think that's a bigger concern. I don't think people are looking so much at the territory itself, as the right-wing opponents of the plan are saying, hey, we shouldn't even be talking about a Palestinian state. And these are not extremists. These are people such as Naftali Bennett and Ayala Shaked. So this is a faction that's going to have to be dealt with going forward, especially if they're needed to make a coalition after the next election.
Right. Now, that's the next question is, politically speaking, Benjamin Netanyahu seems to be all for this plan, all in favor of it, as does Benny Gantz, which is interesting, very supportive. Now, obviously, you know, they want to keep their relationship with Trump very strong, and there's Trump popularity in Israel amongst Israeli voters, which is certainly a factor. How much of a risk is this for them? Politically, what are the repercussions? Will Netanyahu potentially lose support on the right for being so supportive of this deal?
I don't think that Netanyahu will lose support on the right. More the question has been, will Benny Gantz lose some of his supporters on the left for embracing this plan? But I think you're right. I don't think he really has a choice. Number one, Gantz has to play along to a certain extent with President Trump. He doesn't want to start out the new campaign, and he also doesn't want to potentially take over as prime minister or as a top cabinet official in the next government on Donald Trump's bad side. But I think also, despite the fact that Netanyahu in the previous elections has tried to paint Gantz as a leftist, he's not. And neither is Bogi Ayalon, and neither is Yair Lapid when it comes to international and security issues, and neither is Gabi Ashkenazi. The Blue and White Party is not a leftist party. It's a centrist party. And it's not surprising that Gantz would take the position that he has. In fact, when this whole arrangement was first announced and Netanyahu and Gantz coming to America, my feeling was, and actually it still is, that Trump's goal is to try to bring the two of them together, get them on the same page on this plan. And then after the election, assuming that each of them gets 30 plus seats, they can make a national unity government on their own without the addition of any parties. And I think that's what Trump would like to see. And I think that the release of this plan right now was timed just precisely to do that. And he's got a good chance of pulling it off.
Yeah. And do you think this announcement will give Netanyahu a boost in the polls in the next election?
We haven't seen any new polls since. Most of the authoritative polls come out on Fridays because, you know, on the Sunday through Thursday work week. So the Friday papers here in Israel are the equivalent of the Sunday papers
right. And
Sunday news programs in America. So I think we'll see the first real authoritative polls in another couple of days. I would be surprised if it doesn't give Netanyahu a boost. However, the Likud has been slipping in recent polls. And it's also a possibility that we'll see Benny Gantz gaining more strength as more people start to think, you know something, Benny Gantz is really more politically savvy than we thought. And there might be some more people who are likely to go over to his side, maybe even some Lieberman voters. Maybe some old-time labor voters who are thinking right now, you know, something would really be a waste of time at this stage to vote for labor, so why don't we just swing over to Benny Gantz? So while I would probably predict, even though I hate making predictions, but...
sorry, put you on the spot here. That's
things change so often. It's, you know, politics has always been changeable, and politicians are always throwing up trial balloons, so... whatever you hear announced one day could end up disappearing the next day or two. And the shelf life of news anymore is much shorter than...
Yes.
Now, I would say again that I would think you probably see a little bit of uptick for the Likud and Netanyahu, but I have a feeling you're going to see more for Gantz. I say Gantz is the favorite in this election. I've written it in the past in my column, and I would hold by that.
Interesting. I will have to have you back on to get into all of that because that's fascinating. Let's talk about Jerusalem. And I think there's a lot of confusion surrounding the status of Jerusalem in this deal. It calls for an undivided Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which is not a surprise considering that Trump has already recognized that. Yet there will be parts of Eastern Jerusalem past the security barrier that will be the capital of a future Palestinian state, according to this deal. Is that a major concession for the Israelis? And by the way, is that something that the Palestinians have any interest in?
It really isn't a major concession for Israel because basically what I see from this plan is nothing in Jerusalem is going to change. The status quo in the old city is going to be exactly the way it is, where Israel maintains control of everything. As far as the Arab neighborhoods, mainly to the north and the east side of Jerusalem, these neighborhoods have been in existence for decades, and nothing in this plan changes that in the slightest. In fact, the main controversy over these neighborhoods has been over the years whether they should be split off from Jerusalem into a separate Palestinian or Arab entity or whether they should remain part of Jerusalem. There was a long time that most people felt, I shouldn't say most people, but certainly people in the center and the right felt that it was very important to maintain the territorial integrity of Jerusalem and that Israel and the Jewish presence seemed to be in control of every single neighborhood. In recent years, let's say the think tanks, the right-wing think tanks, you've had a lot of scholars basically backing down off that and saying, what do we need these neighborhoods for? They're not really part of Jewish Jerusalem. We don't do too much for them anyway. We don't go in there and let the Arabs run it. So again, I don't see there's been any concessions on Jerusalem, and I don't see that anything in Jerusalem will change as a result of this agreement.
Wow.
One day, if there is a Palestinian state, and if they do end up putting a embassy, if the U.S. ends up putting a embassy in Abu Dis, which is basically a eastern, southeastern neighborhood of East Jerusalem, but it's quite separate from from the old city. It's not far, because nothing in Jerusalem is that far, but it's not adjacent to the old city. So you have to take a little bit of a circuitous route and the type of roads that most people don't take every day to get there. So I don't see that would represent a security threat to Israel either. You know, if they were going to put it right smack in the middle of one of the Arab neighborhoods in Jerusalem, like Beit Safafa or Jebel Mukaber or someplace like that, that would be a different story. But an embassy and a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem, not that it's likely to happen. But if it's in some place like Abu Dis, it's not going to be a factor.
Wow. Now, one other big concession, of course, is the settlement freeze. And just reading here, Israel would freeze all Jewish construction in areas earmarked for the Palestinian state for 4 years, and also cease demolition of illegal Arab construction in the parts of Area C, which the plan envisions as becoming part of the state of the Palestinians. So can you tell us what that means practically, and how big of a concession is that?
The settlement freeze is basically a non-concession. We're basically giving them something we've already given them. People talk about new settlements all the time, and I challenge anyone: go to the West Bank, go take a look at the figures in the Central Bureau of Statistics. Find me one new settlement that the Israeli government has built in the last 25 years since Oslo. There isn't one. There is no new settlement construction. There is some natural growth and very little, I might say, in the existing settlements. But, you know, go to Beit Har Elit and ask people how much growth there's been there. Very little in terms of dealing with the demand that's needed. So that's in the existing settlements. As far as the areas, let's say the 70% of the West Bank that Israel won't be annexing, there never were any Jewish settlements there, probably since the time of Shlomo HaMelech. And there was no construction or any settlements planned for that area anyway. So basically, what we're saying is, okay, so we won't build in an area that we haven't been building in anyway, even after 1967. So that's not a concession. As far as the demolitions are concerned, I do believe the plan reads, if I remember correctly from my browsing through it, that you're right, that we're not supposed to demolish something, any sort of illegal construction. However, if the illegal construction predated this plan, then we will have the right to do something about it.
Right. There is wording about that. And there are other caveats, right, too.
And also, if there's any security threat, then
right,
we have the...
which is very broad. It'll obviously give the Israelis a lot of leeway there. Right, I noticed that. Now, so to sum up, I mean, what I'm hearing from you, Rav Binyamin Rose, is that this deal heavily favors Israel, would be a huge win for the Israelis, despite it technically being called a two-state solution. And it's not a surprise, considering that Trump has been such a staunch supporter of Israel. But is that accurate?
I believe that the deal definitely is advantageous for Israel. Again, we have to point out that the amount of land that Israel will be annexing in the West Bank is only about a half of the area that it fully controls right now. So in a sense, that's the one downbeat
right
note in the entire thing. But basically, it cements Israel's control of the Old City, which is very, very vital. It starts the clock ticking on the Palestinians. They basically have 4 to 5 years to decide whether they want to get on board. And if not, I think everything could be up for grab again. And Israel could go in and say no something because there's no chance of a deal here. So we're going to take a little bit more of the rest of Area C.
So this is already a win? I mean, the Israelis, are they just kind of going to start annexing? Is anything practically going to change here without the Palestinians even coming to the table?
Practically, the most important thing, let's say Israel does annex or apply sovereignty, however you want to phrase it, to the settlements, it'll be very, very important for the people who live there. Number one, it means to some extent dismantling the military governorship that's been ruling the West Bank. Nowadays, let's say if you live in Efrat, or if you live in Ariel, one of the larger cities, or even if you live in a smaller settlement, if you want to build a merpeset, if you want to add another wing to your apartment or your home, so you've got to go to the military governor instead of, let's say, a housing board. Now, Israel bureaucracy is well known for moving very, very slow on any kind of housing changes that anyone wants to make. However, the military governor was a sure veto because of the sensitivity of the situation. Once you have sovereignty or annexation, basically Israeli law will apply to these towns. Instead of apartments being registered in the Tabu of Jordan or in the military governor's record books, people will be able to register their property in Tabu, which is the Israeli property registry, and that makes their chazaka, that makes their hold on the apartment and on their property much stronger. Again, it also means that people will be able to renovate and expand and get permits in a normal way. So Israeli law will apply to these territories in a way that that hasn't before. And the same thing with all sorts of roads and the court system. Instead of, you know, what happens now is that if there's a dispute, let's say between an Arab and a Jew in the West Bank, so what happens? It ends up going almost straight to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court doesn't review whose property it really is. And they just decide basically on however they decide. And we won't get into that in this interview, but under a system where there's Israeli sovereignty in the West Bank, so the property dispute would go to a district court, where all property disputes go, and the district court is set up to examine the competing claims and look at the paperwork and decide who really owns the property. So from a legal point of view, you'll have a much better system of justice in adjudicating disputes. So
very, very interesting. A final question, and I will let you go. I'm curious what you think Trump's game plan here is, because there's no real chance of Abbas coming to the table anytime soon. This is not Oslo, where Trump's going to have a big diplomatic win or a Nobel Peace Prize. So is this just mostly about strengthening Israel, in your opinion, versus a historic deal? Or maybe Trump is thinking long term, that at the end of a second term, he might have some deal come out of this. Do you have any thoughts on that?
That's a really good question. I always have said that President Trump is propelled or impelled by two things. Number one, you know, obviously because of his daughter Ivanka, because of Jared, and because of his many Orthodox Jewish advisors, you know, Jason Greenblatt, Avi Berkowitz, et cetera, et cetera.
It's amazing. So
you know, it's not like he's King Cyrus and told us go back and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, but he's doing as much as he feels he can. But secondly, the other part of his game plan is President Trump wants very much to do more business with the Arab world, especially Saudi Arabia, and with other countries like the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Oman, etc. And a lot of this plan is basically to wean those countries away from a extremist Muslim orbit and into a much more mainstream type of a Middle East that he envisions as being win-win for American business. So it's not just that the president wants to do nice things for Israel. Yes, he does. He's been very good to Israel. But he also thinks he's going to be good to America by increasing and expanding our trade and business agreements with the Arab world. So I think that's the second part of his strategy. So for those who like to say, well, the president has no strategy, look, you know, nobody can possibly have a strategy for the entire world. But I do think when it comes to the Middle East that President Trump has had a strategy all along. And we're seeing more of it unfold as we get towards the end of his first term.
And then I would say those people who think that he lacks strategy, then he's got to be the luckiest person on the planet, because he sure has been very successful. And you don't do that without being strategic.
That's very true. But it's also important to realize that politicians and leaders try a lot of things. And a lot of times when it looks like they don't have a strategy, well, they did have a plan. It's just that it failed. And then they saw it was going to fail. So then they shifted as fast as they possibly can, which is what I mentioned earlier, that you'll have something in the news, you'll have a trial balloon, and then a day or two later it's out, because it could be something that's been in the works for a while. And then all of a sudden they see, you know, something, this isn't going to work, so I've got to try to do something else.
Great point. Rabbi Naaman, as always, your insights and your grasp over these issues is unparalleled. The editor-at-large of Mishpacha magazine, and we really do appreciate you taking the time. It's a pleasure here on the Yaakov M. Show.
My pleasure as well. Thank you.